Shrink Wrap Radio number 291, Comparing Logo Therapy and Positive Psychology with Marshall H. Lewis.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Marshall H. Lewis, M.A., who is a practitioner of logotherapy and also director of a community mental health center serving three counties in southwest Kansas. Marshall earned his diplomate in logotherapy from the Viktor Frankl Institute in 2011. To learn more about Marshall, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Marshall H. Lewis, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you on the show, having you on this show, I should say, because previously I interviewed you about logotherapy on Wise Counsel podcast.
Right, and it's great to be here. It's a pleasure to be on either show.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of knew that I wanted to have you back at some point to get you on Shrink Wrap Radio. I think most of my Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, or at least a lot of them, I have the impression that they listen to Wise Counsel, but just to make sure all of our bases are covered.
Right. I listen to both shows, so.
Yeah, that's what, you've been a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and I guess I now discover a Wise Counsel listener, and I think that's how I came to know about you, right? You corresponded with me about logotherapy. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, I think so. I think so. It's been a while now, but, I'm sure I've sent you emails about logotherapy and maybe, couple of other things here and there.
Yeah. Well, you have your own podcast appropriately named Logo Talk Radio, which focuses on logotherapy. And I recently had the opportunity to hear your latest episode in which you explored the similarities and differences between logotherapy and positive psychology. And I thought that would make a great topic for Shrink Wrap Radio because, as you know, I've been very interested in tracking developments in positive psychology.
Yes, I know. And in fact, it was your podcast that turned me on to positive psychology originally. So it's kind of a coming full circle here with me learning about positive psychology or getting interested in it from your podcasts and then doing the podcast on logotherapy and positive psychology and now coming back here.
Yeah, that really is full circle. And of course, that's what I hope for is that people will find ways to use the content, and so I'm glad it's been helpful to you. Now, I'm not sure all of our listeners will have had the opportunity to listen to our interview about logotherapy on Wise Counsel, so I should probably have you skim over some of the same ground that we covered there. So let's start out by having you tell us what logotherapy is.
Okay. Logotherapy is a form of psychotherapy that was developed by Dr. Viktor Frankl in the early part of the 20th century. It was his reaction, in essence, to Freudian psychoanalysis and Adlerian psychology, where Frankl came to see that the main motivating force in life was not the pleasure principle or a will to power or the inferiority complex, but he felt that the main motivation was to find meaning in life. And so his therapy technique was based on that idea and based upon listening to his patients and putting together and, in essence, categorizing the types of ways in which they found meaning, then putting that into a system of psychotherapy that he could apply.
Okay, well, that is a good thumbnail sketch. Now, some of it, too, came out of his internment in a World War II concentration camp.
That's right. That's right. He was in a concentration camp. He's actually in four camps.
Wow.
for a period of time. And I don't know if that was unusual or not to be transferred around. He had actually put together the core of psychotherapy before he was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And his first book, which in English is published now as The Doctor, published as The Doctor and the Soul, his first book was in his coat lining when he was arrested, and that original manuscript was destroyed. So one of the things that kept him going while he was in the camp was the idea that if he survived, he needed to rewrite that book, which in fact is what he did.
Wow. Boy, I would hate to have to rewrite a book that I had already written.
Right.
It's hard enough the first time. And I have had occasions where, particularly in the early days of computers, when they weren't as solid as they are now, where mm-hmm. I lost manuscripts of things that I had written, not book length, but article length. And there was one article I had to write three or four times, the whole thing, a big long report that I had to write over and over again because the computer kept losing it.
So I
guess that's why I have some feeling for what that experience must have been like. Many listeners probably will have either heard of or will have read Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, in which he talks about his concentration camp experience and how important finding some meaning, even a little tiny shred of meaning, made the difference between living and dying in that environment.
That's right. Man's Search for Meaning is the book that made Frankl a well-known name. And in fact, that's somewhat paradoxical because it was his intention to publish that book anonymously.
Oh, that is paradoxical.
It is.
And I was surprised to learn in our previous interview, you know, that was the only book of his that I was aware of. And I believe I remember you saying there was some rather large number of books that he's written.
There are 32. Actually, there are 34. 32 have been translated into English. And then there's another one that's presently being translated right now. So there are 32 separate books.
Wow.
By Frankl.
Yeah, and so that's quite a legacy to leave. Now, why is it called logotherapy?
Logotherapy comes from the Greek word logos, which Frankl translates as meaning. Now, logos is a word used in philosophy and in religion with a variety of very rich meanings to it. But for him, logos meant meaning. So logotherapy is therapy or healing through the discovery of meaning.
Okay. And of course, you know, I've been doing lots of interviews on Jungian psychology, and it seems to me that there's an important bit of overlap right there.
I think there is a good bit of overlap between Frankl and Jungian psychology. It surprises me that more people haven't noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, Jung and Frankl are the only big names in the history of psychology and psychiatry that have made a deliberate place within their systems to deal with the human spirit.
Well, you know, that would be a good topic for a future show, perhaps, because
sure.
There's probably a lot that could be said around that. And so we'll put that on the back burner for now. At first, I was a little surprised about your comparing logotherapy and positive psychology. It just seemed like they came from totally different worlds. But then after a little bit of thought, it made a lot of sense to me because logotherapy is clearly coming out of the tradition of existential humanistic psychotherapy. And as you probably know, I see positive psychology as a sort of rebirth of humanistic psychology without giving the movement that preceded it much credit.
That's right. And there are a number of logotherapists who feel the same way as you do about that. I hear that quite a bit, that positive psychology is saying some of the same things that logotherapy has said for years, and yet never making a reference or citation to Frankl.
Yeah, right. So let's get into that then.
Let's
look at the similarities and the differences that you outlined so well in your podcast and in a piece that you've written. Now, in your podcast, you begin with definitions. So how do definitions of these two approaches compare?
Well, I think the definitions really say much the same thing. Now, the strength of positive psychology, as I see it, is in creating operational definitions for some of these concepts that perhaps in logotherapy are not defined as clearly. So the positive psychology center at University of Pennsylvania defines positive psychology as the scientific study of the strengths and virtues that enable individuals and communities to thrive. Or as has been said elsewhere, what's right with people rather than what's wrong with people.
Yes, yes. And so that's a good definition of positive psychology. And also, going back to humanistic psychology, certainly a big thrust there was something that I've heard Seligman say, was that psychology spent most of its history focusing on pathology, on what was wrong with people.
Right.
And that he felt that it was high time for psychology to focus on what's right with people, what works for people, what's positive in people. And, of course, that is exactly what I think humanistic psychology was declaring some 40 years ago or more.
That's right. And that's exactly what Frankl was declaring, too. Frankl used to like to quote Goethe, the German poet. And he used to quote him by saying, and this is a paraphrase, of course, that if we take man as he is, we make him worse. But if we take man as he ought to be, we make him what he is capable of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Which is perhaps a more philosophical and poetic way of saying exactly the same thing.
Yes, and also I think of the term human potential.
Yes.
And that was kind of... It seems that both fields are focusing on human potential, although that word has, because of some of the excesses of the, or what were perceived as excesses of the, quotes, human potential movement, as some of these ideas got very popularized and sometimes watered down greatly or abused, I think the term human potential isn't used as widely now, but hey, it should be dusted off and polished up, because it says it really well, I think.
Yes, it does, and I think you're right about that. And that was also a focus of Frankl. I mean, he recognized that the body could get sick, that there could be mental dysfunctions, but he also believed that there was a core of the human person that was incapable of being sick, and that this basic core of strength could be brought to the surface, could be used as a source of health and healing for other physical and psychological problems.
Okay, now I'm not sure, if we've already given us the definition, I know in the paper you wrote, what's your definition of logotherapy then, or Frankl's definition?
Yes, well, the official definition today is an empirically based, meaning-centered approach to psychotherapy, wherein the search for meaning in life is identified as the primary motivational force in human beings. It's also referred to informally as health through meaning, which is the literal translation, if you will, of logotherapy. And as Frankl often said, and as I like to say often, logotherapy is the psychotherapy that relies on the defiant power of the human spirit to discover meaning under any and all circumstances.
I was intrigued by the word empirical in there. Somehow I wasn't expecting empirical to be part of the definition.
That is surprising, especially when you consider that logotherapy comes from an existential and phenomenological background. I think in this case, empirical is being used as opposed to rational, and I'm not a trained philosopher, although Frankl was. And in this case, phenomenology would be based on sensory experience, as would maybe the more laboratory type of empiricism that we're used to and which positive psychology is so good at.
Well, this gets us into another major area that you discuss, which is the philosophical backgrounds or roots of these two approaches. So how do logotherapy and positive psychology compare in terms of their philosophical roots?
Well, here is where the main difference arises, I think. In the early part of the 20th century, certainly, when Frankl was most active, most writing, you had a number of disciplines discovering their primary units of measurement. In physics, you had the atomic theory. In biology, you had the discovery of the cell. And as I'm sure you know, in the history of psychology, you had Wilhelm Wundt trying to determine the structure of consciousness.
Right.
And none of which in psychology and psychiatry really worked out very well, which is why in American behaviorism, there was essentially an abandonment of the idea of consciousness and a focus on observable, empirical, if you will, behavior. Frankl took a different approach in that he brought in the philosophy of phenomenology, which is that some things cannot be reduced to smaller units. That is, cannot be reduced in the philosophical way in which he said it. Consciousness was one of those things. So when Frankl was working with patients, he listened for those aspects of being human that couldn't be reduced to smaller units, such as love, such as experiences of beauty and truth, such as consciousness itself. And so Frankl held these things as being outside the realm of laboratory study, in a sense, in that they couldn't be explained in terms of other things.
Yeah, we hear the term reductionism used.
Right.
And so that, you know, to carry to its to a ridiculous extreme, you'd be trying to understand maybe human emotions in terms of the movement of subatomic particles.
Right.
And while subatomic particles probably do play a role somewhere in there, it's just not the appropriate level to address the phenomena of human experience and human life and human meaning and so on.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So Frankl would compare and contrast his approach really with things like psychoanalysis and behaviorism, where he didn't dispute the findings that they may have developed by trying to reduce these phenomena, but he insisted that it was a mistake to say that human phenomena was nothing but these lower levels of explanation, mm-hmm. that there was always something greater that made you uniquely human. That's his major, major contribution, I feel, to psychotherapy. And also very important for him because as a Holocaust survivor, he saw a tendency toward reductionism as in part responsible for the Holocaust.
Oh, that's interesting. Do I recall that Frankl was trained as a psychoanalyst initially?
He wasn't trained as a psychoanalyst per se. He had kept up a correspondence with Sigmund Freud from the time that he was in high school.
Hmm.
And Freud had invited him to publish a paper in Freud's journal, which he did at a very young age. His first formal association with the school of thought, though, would have been Adler's School of Psychology. He was a member of Adler Society for about 2 years.
Okay. Yeah, I had forgotten that piece of it. So, again, on philosophical background, we pretty much went through the phenomenological, philosophical roots underlying logotherapy. How would you characterize the philosophical background for positive psychology?
The philosophical basis of positive psychology clearly is pure empiricism with an emphasis on research. It has done a good job, I think, of using research-based operational definitions. I think a good example of this is what Martin Seligman was saying in his keynote address about future orientation, an orientation that Frankl would certainly agree with. But then he reduced the idea of humans looking to the future as running if-then calculations in the frontal lobes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we may in fact be running if-then calculations in the frontal lobes, and that may be responsible, at least in part, for our ability to look to the future and to develop meaningful and personal, meaningful and purposeful goals. However, Frankl would argue that it's a mistake to say that our future orientation is nothing but that, that the meaning and purpose that we see in those goals are irreducible aspects of being human.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I keep referring back to humanistic psychology, and I think one of the reasons that Seligman, I suspect consciously, has not talked about the earlier humanistic roots that I would think would underlie his work is that he really wanted to divorce himself from his, from what he saw as that humanistic psychology he felt was just not empirical enough, or even maybe he thought it was not empirical at all. And he really felt that psychology needs, you know, needs to be a science and founded upon experiments and following scientific protocols. And so I think that's, he just didn't want to be tarred with the brush.
I see. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I remember my history of psychology, it was the humanists who did most of the research, empirical research, in what made psychotherapy work.
Yeah, I think, actually, I think you're right. A lot of it grew. Carl Rogers was, in fact, I believe, that either the first or one of the very first people to think that research into psychotherapy needed to be conducted to understand what really, you know, what really worked. And so he trained a lot of students who went on to do considerable amounts of research on psychotherapy. And Carl Rogers was, most people don't realize this, but Carl Rogers was the first person to introduce audio and maybe later video recording into the training of psychotherapists.
Interesting.
Because psychoanalysis had pretty much held sway up until, you know, until Rogers came along. Well, there was the behavioral school too, and that was, of course, quite different. But the psychoanalytic point of view was that the therapeutic relationship is much too sacred to intrude upon with any kind of recording device or observations from the outside, that that would distort the process, that people would be too aware of it, too self-conscious, et cetera, et cetera. But Carl Rogers felt that the higher good was to really reveal the truth of what goes on in the therapeutic hour. And certainly, if one thing that we've really learned is that what people do in that therapeutic hour may be very different than what they have to, either their recollection of it or the theoretical structure that they then impose on their, on what they say they do.
Right, right.
Yeah, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. Okay, well, another area that you go into has to do with the techniques used by the two approaches. So tell us about that.
Okay, sure. I find some of the technique. Now, Dave, are we talking about what I had listed here as techniques, or are we going into things like the pleasant life and the engaged life and things?
What you had listed as techniques.
Okay, okay. Now, the techniques of logotherapy and positive psychology are similar in many ways, I believe. The major techniques of logotherapy are based on Frankl's model of the human person and on certain irreducible characteristics. But the techniques mainly in logotherapy are called paradoxical intention, dereflection, and the Socratic dialogue. Paradoxical intention is something that's often used for anxiety-related kinds of disorders that has to do with getting the client to consciously wish for the thing that they fear most. And this is often done with an element of humor. So, in essence, what happens is the client starts to not poke fun at themselves, but poke fun at the symptom, separate themselves from it, and come to the understanding that they are a person with certain strengths and values and these positive things, that they don't have to be subject to some anxiety or some automatic thought or as is said in the logotherapeutic literature quite a bit. You don't have to listen to every nonsense that comes from yourself.
Now, do you know how far that goes back? Because I know that in short-term therapy, the very term paradoxical intention came up in the Palo Alto group that had Jackson and Satir and Jay Haley, and they were very much influenced by the hypnotherapist Milton Erickson. Mm-hmm. And out of that sort of mix came this idea of paradoxical intention, which is one of the main tools of that approach to therapy. I'm wondering, is this something that maybe Frankl picked up after he came to California, because he did come to California at some point in his life and taught here. And I wonder if he picked it up, or was it already there? Did they discover this separately? Do you have know anything about that?
Yes, it was already there. It was there in the 1920s for Frankl. So they must have discovered it separately. And in fact, Dr. Dave, if you want to give me just a second, I can reach over here to a recent review on the evidence base of paradoxical intention, and I think I can find the first reference to it.
Oh, I don't think that's essential.
Okay.
We'll take your word for it.
Okay. Yes, but it was there originally as part of logotherapy, because it grew out of his understanding that the human spirit, or the noetic dimension, had these irreducible qualities, including humor, that could be used in a therapeutic way.
Okay. So I sort of fastened on paradoxical intention. I think there were a couple of other techniques that you highlighted.
Sure. Dereflection is the other technique, the other major technique. It involves identifying positive goals, positive values, and then focusing one's attention on accomplishing these goals or living out these values. In a very simple way of saying it, it's putting your mind on something else, or getting your mind on something else, or as a lot of my clients like to say, they need to stay busy. But it's not just distracting yourself, and it's not just getting busy for the sake of being busy. It's identifying what's meaningful to you, and then spending your time in thought and in action on doing those things that are the most meaningful. And in that way, the other symptoms are reduced.
Why is it called dereflection? That term doesn't, I don't see an obvious tie-in to what you just described.
Right. Dereflection for Frankl comes from its opposite term, which is the symptom, hyperreflection. And that is perhaps obsessing on something or worrying about something. He called that hyperreflection, thinking too much about something.
Okay, now it makes sense. Yeah, I was thinking maybe it was something like that, but I wasn't sure. Any other observations about techniques of logotherapy?
The other technique is called Socratic dialogue, which is used in a number of therapies, although it's often called Socratic questioning, asking questions to try to help the person discover what they already know. In logotherapy, the emphasis is placed on dialogue. So it's not just questioning. It's also talking and reflecting, again, with a reflection on the strengths that the client is bringing to the discussion that the client often may not be aware of. So very often a client might come in and discuss some traumatic experience, something bad that's happened to them, some problem that they're having. In Socratic dialogue, of course, the logotherapist would listen empathetically, but would also either ask about or point out areas of strength, much like the positive psychologist would do, point out areas of strength that is also obvious, and how well the client has been able to cope with this trauma, or the strengths and abilities and skills that they used to be able to survive the problem, or to handle the problem as well as they have.
Yes, that sounds very much like positive psychology, so that's definitely an area of commonality.
That's right. And in fact, the Socratic dialogue is the most common technique of logotherapy, whereas the other two generally are used less frequently and with more specific types of diagnoses or specific types of presenting problems.
Yeah, I don't know if the Socratic part of it would be so prominent in positive psychology, but the focus on the person's strengths definitely would be.
Exactly. In positive psychology, they tell you to identify your strengths and do more of that, mm-hmm. and less of trying to fix the weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Logotherapy does the same thing through Socratic dialogue and also through dereflection, is to think less about weaknesses and more about strengths, which logotherapy often uses the word values, it seems, for what positive psychology calls strengths. Focus more on strengths in living out values rather than worrying about weaknesses.
In positive psychology also, in addition to talking about strengths, also sometimes talks about values as values. Mm-hmm. And as part of your exploration of these two approaches, you completed a values inventory from both disciplines.
I did.
Yeah, so maybe you can share that exploration with us.
Okay, let me start with the positive psychology piece. And I took one of their online tests. You know, they have a number of online tests at the Positive Psychology Center. And I took the VIA mm-hmm. test, which is values inventory of strengths, I think, or anyway, values in action. That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
And then it's values in action, VIA, and then the inventory of strengths. And they identify your top five strengths. And then this is where they come in and say, do more of these things. Don't worry about trying to do more of the areas that you're weaker in. Do more of these things. And they identified my top five as curiosity and interest in the world, number one, hope, optimism, and future-mindedness, number two, love of learning was number three, number four was judgment, critical thinking, and open-mindedness, and number five was spirituality, sense of purpose, and faith.
Okay. And then you also took this, well, first I should ask you, does that accord with your sense of yourself? Does that feel accurate? Does it feel like you learned anything?
It does, largely. Yes, I would say that's accurate, sure. But then one thing I would point out is that the VIA, being a test, has to be reductionist to a point. I mean, there are only so many things that the test will measure, and there are so many possible outcomes on the test.
Yes.
And I say that to contrast it with the logotherapy tool that I used, which is called A Workbook to Increase Your Meaningful and Purposeful Goals. That's published by a logotherapist named Bob Hutzel.
Okay.
And it is more of an open-ended type of procedure, I would say, rather than a test. Now, the VIA, I think it took me about a half an hour. It's 220 items.
That's sort of multiple choice, or choose one of two, or true-false.
Right, right. It's a multiple choice, or maybe it's a Likert-type scale in there. But, you're testing my memory now, Dave. Okay. That's another test.
I would not score high on that one myself.
Yeah, but it's something along those lines, like a true-false test.
So the logotherapy workbook is more open-ended? Is it more of a sort of fill-in-the-blank or write a paragraph?
It's along those lines. It does have a concrete aspect to it, but let me explain how it works. It's in three sections, first of all. The first section is a series of exercises to help you identify what your major values are. And that would be the part that corresponds to the VIA. It's intended to be taken over a period of a couple of weeks, doing a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so an example of an item from the first part of the workbook would be to think back to when you were a child and identify what you wanted to be when you grow up. It's the first thing that came to your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then pick out maybe four other jobs that you think you would like, excluding the one that you have.
Do you remember what yours were? That's a good example. Yeah. I'm curious.
Yes, Yes, I do. I don't have it right in front of me, but I remember the first thing I wanted to be when I was growing up, and this will tell you a lot about me right here. I wanted to be a starship captain.
Uh-huh. All right.
I was a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
I wanted to be the captain of a Federation starship. So you see, it doesn't have to even be a real job.
Mm-hmm.
But you get these about five different things, and then you ask yourself, why would anyone want this job? What is it about this job that you like?
Mm-hmm.
And for each of these five, you end up with about three reasons. So say, why would anybody want to be a starship captain? Well, there's autonomy. There's a sense of discovery, sense of exploration and adventure.
Okay. And I remember there was an item like that in your top five on the VIA.
There is. And that actually came out to be on the top on both of the scales, actually, was exploration and discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So even from that single question, you started to get an idea of that.
Yeah.
But then the workbook goes in and it asks you not just about work, but about other things. What types of events have you voluntarily attended over the past year? What type of music have you listened to? Why would anybody want to listen to that or to attend this or to go to this type of activity? And over a couple of weeks with a number of these items, you start to have a whole lot of values listed, why anyone would want to do that. And then basically you start counting them up. How many times did discovery and exploration come up? How many times did appreciation of art and beauty come up? How many times did autonomy come up? And the ones that come up the most, the ones that you repeat the most in a variety of different contexts, are then identified as your top values. But in the Logotherapy workbook, it's entirely open-ended. There is no... the value can be anything. It's whatever you come up with. There's no prepackaged set of values that the test identifies.
Okay.
It's however you define this thing.
Okay. And how did you define your top five from that workbook?
My top five from the Hutzel workbook was number one, discovery and exploration, which I think is very much like curiosity and interest in the world on the VIA.
Yes.
But number one, discovery and exploration. Number two, beauty and spirituality, which in my case merged together into one thing. That wouldn't necessarily be the case for everyone, of course. Number three was art and creativity. Number four, love. And number five, sensuality, romanticism.
Okay. So I would imagine that in both cases, a therapist could work with these tools once the person had taken the inventory and use it to kind of direct the treatment, if you will.
Right.
Using what came out of these inventories, that the logotherapist could use this very fruitfully for an ongoing Socratic dialogue of the sort that you described. And the positive therapist might keep referring back to this as they talk to the person about their life.
They might. And in fact, in the Logotherapy workbook, I'll mention this too, that's just the first part of the workbook. The second and third parts of the workbook then apply those values in a potentially therapeutic way, or at least goal-setting way, because in the second part of the workbook, you identify your short and long-term goals, and it runs through another process. What would your short and long-term goals be in one condition where you're expected to live for a long time? Then it also says, what if you knew you were going to die in 5 years? What if you knew you were going to die in 12 months? What would your short and long-term goals be then? And you come up with a set of goals. Then, and this is the kicker for Logotherapy, I think, in the third part of the workbook, it has you match up your goals and your values and then asks the question, do you have values listed here that are clearly important to you that you're not doing anything about, that you've set no goals for?
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, are you working toward things? Do you have goals set for yourself that really don't fulfill or represent any of your values? And if so, why are you wasting your time doing that?
Yes.
So it brings your action into line with your values or in line with what you believe in to live a richer, more meaningful life.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me. Now, you also talk about some current directions and research, I guess, for both disciplines. Maybe you can touch on those just a bit here.
Well, as you know, the research being done in positive psychology is impressive and extraordinary right now, primarily because of their relationship with the U.S. Army, with their GAT test, or their global assessment tool, that's been given to every man and woman in the U.S. Army. They have a huge database of positive psychology concepts, things like spiritual resilience and other types of resilience, mm-hmm. social resilience, family resilience. And they're able to do correlational studies with outcomes on things like suicide, on things like early promotion, on things like drug abuse, and are able to really see what strengths and resiliences protect against these things, and the absence of which ones tend to lead to these things. Then the Army has developed these online training modules to try to build resilience and overcome deficiencies that are identified in the test. So with the funding and the sample size to do that kind of research, I would expect that the positive psychology movement would discover tremendous things that would be quite also marketable in the current healthcare reform climate, where you're talking about controlling costs and you're talking about improving health more in very precise ways that are also cost-effective ways. So, for example, and I think this was an example that Seligman gave, in the not-too-distant future, a person who rates high on the quality of their marriage may be given a lower dose of antibiotics if they have an infectious disease, because it's known that a good marriage is a protective factor against infection. So that's the kind of very practical nuts and bolts research that's being done by positive psychology that is impressive.
Yeah, Seligman has brought a lot of money into the field, a lot of credibility, because he had so much credibility at the time. He was president of the American Psychological Association, and he had a long research career both on optimism and also on learned helplessness. And he garnered $100,000 prizes for a number of years for the best research. And I've forgotten what the number is. I'm sure I announced it on a previous show, but they got something. He counted something like 50,000 articles in the first 10 years, 50,000 research studies conducted in the first 10 years of positive psychology. So they have an amazing track record. Is there such a thing as logotherapy research?
Oh, yes, there is. There is. Logotherapy research has been carried out ever since the days of Frankl, and it's sound research, but it's not as dramatic as what you see in positive psychology. Logotherapy has been focused on being a therapy. So what you've seen in logotherapy research would be usually lone professors, probably the only logotherapist in a department, doing clinical studies that then get published on paradoxical intention or dereflection. Right now you see, especially in the University of Mississippi, a lot of work being done on the measurement of meaning in life. And that's done in a logotherapeutic context, where you're coming up, or where the researchers there are coming up with operational definitions for some of Frankl's key concepts. What logotherapy lacks compared to positive psychology is a central driving force like Seligman and the Positive Psychology Center, and certainly the funding.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what you have individual researchers scattered around the world doing good research, but good research in, well, good research alone in departments that are not logotherapy departments. So that's the state of the research right now. And right now, one of the things that logotherapy is working toward is reviewing the evidence base of all of their procedures, doing meta-analysis of previous research, and trying to position logotherapy for the changes in healthcare where evidence-based practices will be certainly a critical part of any type of third-party reimbursement system that appears to be the wave of the future. Mm-hmm. And that research is there. It's just now being pulled together. It's just now being pulled together in a way that is fully scientifically sound.
Well, excellent. So let's just sum up here with you kind of summarizing the major differences and the major similarities.
Okay. Well, I think the major differences, or the major difference for sure, is that logotherapy views aspects of the human person as being irreducible. And by that I mean there are things about being human that cannot be explained in terms of smaller units. There are things about being human that cannot be measured in a laboratory in the way that laboratory science has to work, which is through operational definitions.
Okay.
These things are things like love, are things like appreciation of truth and beauty, are things like the actual apprehension of meaning. This is where logotherapy as a therapy is potent and powerful, because those are the things that motivate people and that make them want to live and that give them a rich and full life, which is the goal of logotherapy and also the goal of positive psychology. I think the similarities are that both logotherapy and positive psychology believe that it's been a mistake to focus on the past as far as looking to the past as the main motivation of human beings, and instead focus on pulls from the future, goals, values that are meaningful. I think they're both right in that the emphasis on good mental health, good psychological functioning, is to do more of what one is good at, to accentuate the strengths rather than try to spend so much time on overcoming the negatives.
Okay, well, that's an excellent summary. And as we wind down here, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at my own test results. My test results on the VIA identified things that I absolutely agree with, like the value of discovery and the value of exploration. But it missed the romanticism, and it missed the love, and it missed those things that also give my life personally a great deal of meaning and value. And I think it's interesting and telling, perhaps, that the logotherapy approach identified those right away, and the VIA missed that part. And I think maybe it missed that part because those are the things that are irreducible and can't really be tested empirically.
Okay, well, thanks for being willing to share that. And thank you also for this excellent and thought-provoking comparison of these two approaches that at first blush might seem to have no relationship. But in fact, I think there's a lot of overlap. And I've encouraged you to try to be a presenter at the next World Congress on positive psychology. And I say this as a person who has no power and no influence there, but I believe it's definitely possible. So Marshall H. Lewis, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with logotherapist Marshall H. Lewis and found the comparison between logotherapy and positive psychology instructive. Marshall is in the last stages of finishing up his doctoral dissertation on logotherapy, and I think he's going to be a major player in helping to drive logotherapy toward greater visibility, a process he's already started with his podcast, Logo Talk Radio, which you can find in iTunes. In fact, it was Marshall who first alerted me to the upcoming weekend conference in Vienna this March. As you may recall, for a while I was planning to attend that conference in my capacity as a journalist, but wasn't able to work out satisfactory flight arrangements using my mileage card points. If you're in the Vienna area, I believe the conference is open to all. You can find information about the conference on Marshall's blog at marshallhlewis.blogspot.com. I believe a major focus of the weekend conference will be how to make logotherapy more widely known. It turns out that even though there are quite a few logotherapists and a Viktor Frankl Institute in Vienna, this very viable approach is not as widely known as it deserves to be. Even though I won't be attending the 2012 Vienna conference, I've offered to help in that effort by featuring a number of interviews with a variety of logotherapists here on Shrink Wrap Radio, with the idea of eventually being able to offer CE units, that's continuing education units, for listening to that collection. So you can expect to be learning more about logotherapy over the coming months.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Happy New Year, everyone. As I record this segment, today is January 3rd of 2012. And the year is off to a good start here, in as much as Wise Counsel podcast was one of 10 podcasts listed in the January 2012 issue of the American Psychological Association's publication, Monitor on Psychology. It used to just be called The Monitor. I guess they changed their name. At any rate, the article on pages 22 and 23, titled Psychology's Growing Library of Podcasts, says, among other things, quote, psychology continues to expand its reach with podcasts that showcase the academic, the scientific, and the clinical sides of the field, end quote. Needless to say, I really appreciate the recognition from our leading professional organization. And speaking of Wise Counsel, if you haven't done so already, be sure to listen to the latest Wise Counsel podcast, an interview with Dan Rima on trauma and art. Dan's story is a fascinating one. He survived a potentially deadly combination of three different strains of dengue fever, which had the effect of unlocking an incredible flow of artistic talent. We have a new transcript on the site. I want to thank Charlie Bathgate for stepping forward to transcribe Shrink Wrap Radio number 288, The Buddha Occupies Wall Street, with Shokin Michael Stone. That was such a timely interview, if I do say so myself, and I'm really pleased that we now have a transcript of it as well. We can always use more help with transcripts, and if you'd like to support the show in that way, please drop me an email. Don't forget that you can earn CE units, that's continuing education units for professionals, on such topics as dreams, on positive psychology, and on Jungian approaches to psychotherapy, just by listening to selected podcasts. Currently, we have 20 continuing education units available, with more on the way. Just go to the store tab on our site for additional information. Once again, I want to thank our super colossal donor, Katie Morrison, proprietor of Morrison Mentoring in and around Melbourne, Australia. You can find out more about her services at www.morrisonmentoring.com.au. Won't you consider joining Katie by advertising your business through a super colossal membership for $30 a month for 12 months or by taking out a banner ad on our site. There's a lot of time and preparation that goes into each and every one of these episodes. If you've not yet become a financial contributor, you can get your new year and ours off to a great start by clicking on that big green donate button on the Shrink Wrap Radio page and choosing the level that best fits your budget. Do it now.
This is Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's take a look at some recent communiques from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Dave, who responded to my thanks for his financial support. And Dave writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. It's nice to hear from you. I'm a 49-year-old lawyer in Kansas City, Missouri, and have become a big fan of both your podcasts. I finally remembered to make a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio to give a small contribution back for the work that you do and the significant benefits a lot of us have gained, myself included, from listening. Also, I want you to know that I find you to be a very good interviewer and you come across as a warm, kind-hearted, and thoughtful person. I'm glad my donation gave you a shot in the arm, and I promise it won't be the last. Thanks again for all of your hard work." And that's from Dave. And Dave, thank you so much for your observations. I'm so glad not only for your donation, but for your listenership. And I'm glad that I come across as warm, kind-hearted, and thoughtful. Those are all great qualities. And it's good to know that there's at least one lawyer out there. Actually, I'm working on a podcast for Wise Counsel podcast on forensic psychology, so that's one that you're likely to be interested in. Next, we hear from Oscar in Sweden, who posted comments about Shrink Wrap Radio number 298. You'll recall that was on ally work with Dr. Jeff Raff, Jungian analyst. Oscar wrote, "Your comment on the ally, quotes, one has to nurture and love the ally as well, end quote, reminded me of something I began to grasp last summer but then forgot about. Jung's autobiographical remark that the entities, all of them, of the unconscious are uninformed about our world. It's like nothing happens down there until we visit them. They are bored to death if they don't get any news." This may sound like a nifty intellectual idea, but I had a vivid revelation during a shamanistic ceremony that confirmed this intuition on the experiential level. Although extremely powerful, it appears as if many of these beings are in a way starving unless we nurture them with, quote, soul food. They seem to have a childish or animal-like way of relating. You know, if a parent has been away from his or her child for too long, the kid may greet the parent with a mix of aggression and clinging, as if to punish the adult for the delay. After a while, the quarantine is over and they can start to relate normally again. The same seems to be the case with the creatures of the unconscious. The less attention I paid them recently, the rougher the welcoming. But if I endure, they often become more friendly and cooperative. This goes for dream work, active imagination, hypnosis, as well as shamanistic work. And if the two worlds are symmetrical, why should one rule the other? It does not make sense. It feels humbling to think that the unconscious also needs our support and cooperation to evolve. It evokes a sense of responsibility and vigilance. Thank you for reminding me. Well, Oscar, thank you for these observations. I think Dr. Raff would probably agree with you, and I'd hope to get him to respond here, but I guess he's just too busy to do that. And I'm always humbled by the intelligence that you bring to your comments and the depth of your experiences. Now, Tracy also wrote about that same interview with Dr. Raff. And she writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I just wanted to tell you that I'm really enjoying all the Jungians you have been having on your show. I especially like Jeff Raff. I attended one of Jeff's workshops at the Oregon Friends of Jung a few years ago, but your interview really helped me with the concept of the ally, which I struggled with even after the workshop. Thanks and best wishes, Tracy. Tracy, thanks so much for that feedback, and I'm really glad to hear that interview hit home. Heather, who is a new listener, writes, "Hi there, I just listened to your old interview with Fern Cohen about In Treatment." That's the HBO video series. Having finished watching the final season of the show a couple weeks ago, I was astonished at how well you both called out the issues the show eventually had to deal with in the last season, particularly about his supervision slash therapy with Gina and his lack of appropriate boundaries. While the show did lapse into soap opera for a long while there, it's like the writers then listened to your podcast and addressed everything you both spoke about. Uncanny and delightful to hear your earlier thoughts about watching the whole show. Any plans for a post-series follow-up? I would love to hear more conversation between you and Cohen. Glad to have stumbled upon your site. Heather, thanks for that feedback. And, you know, I still need to contact Fern Cohen, see if maybe she would be up for that. I have to say that I did not finish watching the last season because it was so painful, and it just seemed like work to sit through those sessions. And my feeling was, hey, if I have to sit through that much pain, I should be getting paid for it. So I stopped watching. It feels like maybe I need to go back and finish the series. Finally, Daniel wrote to thank me for shortening the intro music for the show. He was the one who had been somewhat critical about the repetitive nature of the intro that I was recently using. He writes, "Dr. Dave, sounds great," referring to the shortened intro. "Thanks for considering my feedback. Also, it might be cool to interview Peter Levine or Stephen Hoskinson, who practice somatic experiencing, which is a short-term modality for healing trauma. Thanks," and that's from Daniel. Daniel, I'll look into that. That sounds like a good suggestion. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows, just like Oscar did, in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And I forgot to promote the iPhone and Android apps, and that's another way that you can contact me. And you can find info about how to get those apps on our site. Thanks again to my guest, Marshall H. Lewis, for his insights into the similarities and differences between logotherapy and positive psychology. My next episode will feature an interview with yet another Jungian, Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky, and we'll be speaking about her book, The Mother Line, which is about the journey to discover the roots of the feminine psyche. It should be of interest not only to our female listeners, but also to those men who wish to better understand them. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.